Hey there, this is Daniel Messer, the Cyberpunk Librarian. Before we get to the show, I wanted to take a few seconds to tell you about a fundraiser I'm holding to help me get to Minneapolis and the Innovative Users Group Conference in April 2015. I submitted a speaking proposal a while back, and lo and behold, they accepted it. I was actually kind of surprised because it's kind of a geeky talk, but hey, they accepted it, so I can go. Now, I've spoken at state and local conferences before, but this would be my first National Library Conference speaking gig, and I'm really excited. The thing is, money and budgets are tight at libraries everywhere. After all, that's one of the reasons this show exists, because of the high-tech, low-budget world that librarians find themselves in day after day. So, the library I work for probably won't be able to send me or help me out with this conference. That's just the reality of the situation. I've got some money socked away, but it would be great if I could get some help offsetting the cost of a trip to Minneapolis and the conference. If you have an interest, check out my GoFundMe site at gofund.me/cyberpunklibrarian. And hey, if you can kick in, that would be great. We do have some time, and I know the holidays are upon us, and money is probably tight for a lot of people right now. But we have time. Either way, you can read more about it at gofund.me/cyberpunklibrarian, and if you can kick in a little, thank you so much. And if you can't, hey, that's okay too. This show is still free and always will be. Hey, thanks for listening to my spiel, and thanks for listening to the show. Coming up in 4, 3, 2... Hey there, and welcome to Cyberpunk Librarian. I'm Daniel Messer. The first time I heard the words busy hands or happy hands, they came from my mother. She was actually talking about my dad, who is a barber, woodworker, plumber, musician, quilter, mechanic, sewer, welder, and so much more. I inherited a similar thing from him where I'm happier when I'm doing something. Could be writing, could be composing a song, playing a video game, recording a podcast, coding on some script, hacking on a Raspberry Pi, whatever. It's not so much a busy hands issue, it's a mental thing. When I'm doing something creative, I'm happy. So I added a bit to my mom's adage by saying, busy hands are happy hands, and an occupied mind isn't homicidal. Technology is a playground for me, both at home and at work. Recently, in the Nightwise community on Google+, Matthew Williams, aka Lord Drakenblut, asked, what kind of projects are you working on? I answered with a couple of things, and then I thought, hey, that might be a good idea for an episode. This is Cyberpunk Librarian, episode 26, Busy Hands. My name is Daniel Messer, your friendly neighborhood cyberpunk librarian, and hey, welcome back to the show that explores the intersections of libraries and technology, and is all about living that high-tech, low-budget lifestyle. So, today's show will be about some projects that I'm working on, and I think, well, I hope, those will be interesting to my listeners. Because they're things that you can do at your library or in your home, perhaps both, and not only will you learn cool new stuff, but you'll end up with something useful. Now, I'm not going to go too in-depth on these projects, because there's a few of them, and quite frankly, I'm not doing anything that you consider bleeding edge or groundbreaking. But that's the beauty of it in some ways, because that means these projects are things that you can do yourself and not have to create entirely new wheels and entirely new gears to get the job done. So, as my regular listeners are aware, I often break the show into a couple of parts. Now, if you're a new listener, welcome! I typically break the show into a couple of parts. Yeah, hi. And hey, those parts are going to be projects at work and projects at home, and a bit of the overlap between them, because at work, I'm a web guy. At home, I'm also a web guy. I make things that sooner or later go someplace on the web, so you can download them, look at them, listen to them, watch them, whatever. It's on the web someplace. Okay? So, are you ready to get crazy? Are you ready to do insane, extreme things? Are you ready to risk life and limb to accomplish greatness? Then wow, you're in the wrong place, my friend, because we're going to talk about library technology. So I've got a couple projects at work, and I got a couple of projects at home. And these are by no means the only things I'm working on. These are just sort of the more important projects that sort of come to a head and typically get more time spent on them than the other projects that don't have as much time spent on them. So at work, I'm doing a couple things. One involves hardware, and the other involves software. And of course, they kind of both come together in the hardware and software arena. That's how technology works. So a little update on something that I've covered before in a previous episode, which is a Raspberry Pi-based digital signage and digital shelf talker thing that I've been working on. Now, what this is using a Raspberry Pi hooked to a repurposed monitor. In other words, a monitor that we're probably going to surplus eventually, but we can't just throw away. I mean, it's a working monitor. We need some spares, but we've got quite a few of them that are literally just kind of sitting around, not doing much of anything. So we decided to see if we could do something with them using a Raspberry Pi. And one of the things that came up is sort of a digital shelf talker, kind of like you might see at a Walmart or Target sitting on an end cap. But this one doesn't play noise because no one wants to hear the same noise and the same music and the same audio over and over again all day long. I mean, if you ever walk through the electronics section at Target and they keep playing the same commercial over and over and over again, I mean, wow, that's got to get on someone's nerves sooner or later. I guess you either tune it out or it drives you mad. I'm not sure if there's any middle ground there at all. So to update folks on what I've been doing there, I was using a thing called Screenly OSE. Now, OSE is short for Open Source Edition. And what this is a bit of software you can install on a Raspberry Pi, and it allows you to set up slides and set up video and set up all kinds of things on the Pi, and you can decide when slides go up and come down and things like that. It's basically a digital signage solution that's open source. It's very well done, and I do like Screenly OSE. But there was another strategy I found out about and learned a little bit about when I went to one of the local airports and discovered how they're doing some of their digital signage. And as it happens, they're also using Raspberry Pis, which I thought was really cool. So turns out they're not using a sort of digital signage manager at all. They're just simply hooking up a Raspberry Pi and making a few changes to the default browser on this Pi, which I believe is Midori, and basically running Midori in a kiosk mode and feeding it images from a web server. Well, I thought that's not too bad an idea because that opens up some possibilities and some different strategies that I don't get with Screenly OSE. So Screenly OSE is good, but I think for our needs, a kiosk solution is kind of better. And I'll tell you why. Because Screenly OSE is sort of a point-by-point management system. So when you're using Screenly OSE, you're connecting to a Raspberry Pi through a web-based interface, a browser, and managing it that way. There's no real good way without paying money to get a sort of setup where you can manage multiple Screenly running devices. So if I have a block of, say, 5 digital shelf talkers or digital signs that are sitting in periodical sections in various branches, well, if I want to change the slides on those, I have to hit all 5 of them. I have to go to one, make the change, then I have to go to the other and make the change and go to the third and make the change and so on and so on. So that's okay. I mean, that's not hard and it's just time. But I could spend time doing other things, and after talking to the folks at the airport, I kind of came up with another sort of strategy for this, and I'm liking how it's working out. So I'm not a huge fan of Midori. It's got some bugs in it with its kiosk mode. However, Chromium, which is sort of the open source version of Google Chrome, does not have those bugs in a kiosk mode. And Chromium offers some real interesting advantages when it comes to that kiosk mode. So what I've tried here recently is I've got 4 Raspberry Pis hooked up to monitors and running just in a Chromium kiosk mode. Now, the great thing about Chromium is that you can start it easily from the command line, and with a couple of switches, which I will put in the show notes, you can start it up and say, I want Chromium to run in a kiosk mode. I don't want you to show me any error dialogues. And what this does is suppress anything that might happen if the power goes out. And if you don't suppress the error dialogues when it comes back up, Chromium will say something about, hey, you didn't shut me down correctly. Do you want me to restore the page that you were looking at? Stuff like that. You want to suppress that. So with a command line and a couple switches, you can say, hey, start Chromium. I want you to suppress all the error dialogues. I want you to run in a full screen kiosk mode. And I want you to call upon this website for pictures, content, whatever. So I got that set up. And since I'm using Raspbian on the Raspberry Pis, you're running in LXDE, which is a desktop environment for those who may not be familiar with Linux. I'll have some links in the show notes for LXDE. It's a great desktop environment, very lightweight and perfect for the Raspberry Pi. So you do have to install Chromium. That's pretty easy. And once you call it up using the command line, you can point it at that web server. Now, this is also something that I kind of got into that was interesting, because this is sort of a test run. I didn't want to set up a full Apache web server or call up on an IIS web server or something like that. I just wanted something that I could get up and running and it can be there. And it's an internal thing anyway. It doesn't go out to the public sort of places and all of that. So I just need something that's a web server. And I stumbled across this thing called Cherokee. So kind of keeping with the whole Apache, Cherokee, Native American tribe thing, Cherokee is a very simple web server with a lot of possibility. It has something in it that I would love to see in Apache, and that is a very good browser-based management interface. So once you start Cherokee, you can go to a local IP and a port, I believe it's 8080 or something like that. When you start it, it tells you where, you know, what URL you need to access, and it's a local access. And it gives you a temporary admin password and login. So there you go. So once you bring this up, you're looking at your web server, and it's sort of IIS in nature, where you can manage the web server through the web browser, and it's so easy. And I've been fiddling around with it. It's not quite as fully featured as Apache is, but it does have the ability to do things like PHP and MySQL and that kind of integration that you would expect from a robust web server. So I gotta recommend Cherokee web server to you if you're just looking for something you can set up real quick and have up and running in 5 to 10 minutes, if that. No fiddling about with config files, no naffing about with sudo nano config.txt, none of that. Just download it, install it, and run it, and you have a web server for all of your web server needs as far as testing and backend stuff. I haven't put it out on a sort of open web kind of thing at all yet. I'll fiddle with that, but if you're looking for a web server that's simple and easy to use, you got to check out Cherokee. I'll have links in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. Check those out. So the great thing about this Chromium kiosk mode is I can have blocks of these digital signage things, these digital shelf talkers, talking to simply different directories on the web server. They can go to a periodicals directory and pull content from there. They can go to an e-sources directory and pull content from there. And I can tell which pies to do which. And the trick with this is you can use JavaScript or an HTTP refresh or whatever to have the website or the index.html file reload itself every so often. I have mine set to every 20 minutes, just reload the page. And what that does is it goes and checks for new content. So say I've got a digital shelf talker in the periodicals section, and we've got some slides going that's got magazines and maybe a Zinio promotion and things pointing to e-sources. Hey, we don't have this magazine, but you can pick it up on one of our databases. You know, stuff like that, stuff that you would want to do and want to call attention to for your patrons and customers. but, you know, we get a new slide or we've got this new thing that we want to put out there. Well, if I were using Screenly OSC and I had five of these, going back to my original example, I have to go to all five of them, update the slide, upload it to all of these little Raspberry Pis, and that's fine. Like I said, that's easy and it's just a little bit of time. But with this Chromium kiosk mode, I simply go to my web server and I change my index.html to update it to the new stuff. Hey, I've got this new slide. Maybe I take a slide down. Maybe I just add the slide in, whatever. And in 20 minutes or less, the little Raspberry Pis are going to reload their pages, just like I've set them to every 20 minutes. And they're going to say, oh, hey, look, there's new stuff in the index.html. So it's going to just pull those things automatically. And I don't have to do anything. I only have to upload the new image, and I only have to change the index.html. I really only have to mess with a couple files, and that is nice, especially if you've got blocks of these things around. So I could do that for periodicals. I could do it for things in a given fiction area. Say we've got two Raspberry Pi shelf talkers in fiction promoting different things, and we update both of them. Well, I update both of them on one server in one directory. That seems like a better strategy for me. I'm still playing with it, and I'll have some code and links in the show notes for all of this stuff too. So check that out, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. And sort of that's the update on the Raspberry Pi thing, except for one thing that I ran into, which I want to share with all of you because it was such a bear for me. And if you're thinking about doing something like this at your library, you really need to look into this. So if you're going to have a little Raspberry Pi and it's going to be sitting there and it's going to just be displaying slides or whatever, you want to make sure that the screen doesn't go to sleep. It doesn't, you know, go into low power mode. It doesn't sort of shut itself off. It doesn't go to screensaver. And wow, that is not intuitive with Raspbian. You have to edit a couple of files. Actually, just one. Now that I think about it, you have to edit one file. And I will have a link in the show notes to the code that will allow you to do this. You add a line of code to a config file. It's in the Light DM manager. So yeah, you add that in and that stops it. That stops the screen blanking. And I want to throw that out there because there are a bunch of projects that have to do this kind of thing. It doesn't have to be a kiosk, but there are several Raspberry Pi projects I can think of off the top of my head that you don't want that screen to go to sleep. You always want it to be showing something. So I'll throw that in the show notes, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast, and you can pick that up there, pop that into your into the config file that's necessary, and hopefully that will save you a whole bunch of time because, yeah, I probably worked a couple, 3 hours on trying to get this to work before I finally found the solution that actually works. So, okay, that's there for you. Moving on. We're going to talk about something that's kind of specific to what I do because we run the Polaris Public Access Catalog as our front end. So that comes with challenges all on its own. But some of the things that I worry about is making sure that there's new and interesting content up there as often as possible, making sure that stuff is fresh, things aren't expired, things aren't happening and showing up after the event has happened, stuff like that. And like many library sites, we have a slide deck on the website that's just JavaScript, jQuery, whatever. Now that's fine and dandy, but the thing is the slide deck is showing slides about upcoming events. And you want those slides to go up a certain time before the event so people know about it in advance, and you want them to come down after the event is over. Now, the sort of good news is that the Polaris Power Pack, and I'm sure other packs out there, running on Microsoft IIS, which is Microsoft's web server, is running in an ASP.NET environment. So we are talking C# code. Now, the great thing about C# code is you can throw that into your websites and do interesting things with it. Now, I am not a C# developer. I want to make sure that people know that. I can hack C# together. I can use Stack Exchange and places like that to help me, and Google with the best of them. And that is what I usually wind up doing. But I've got something together that I wanted to share, and I will throw this out there in the show notes as well. But let me give you a sort of overview of our setup. So when you visit the library's website, you are actually being taken to a default.aspx, or aspects as I call it, file. And that just builds the library site dynamically. That's what aspects files do in a .NET environment. However, that aspects file has an include within it that calls an index.html file, which is pretty much straight HTML, with the exception of some JavaScript, jQuery, and C#. Now, the C# and JavaScript and jQuery stuff are really only there for that slide deck. So that's fine. But the C# code itself is what makes the slides go up and come down at given days and times. So for most events, I usually push the slide out to the website maybe a week or a week and a half before the event happens. That way there's plenty of time to sort of promote, but you're not, you know, doing it months in the future or anything like that where people are going to forget all about it because they've seen that slide too many times and they've sort of become numb to it. So about a week and a half before the event, that slide goes live, and then it comes down the day of the event about half an hour before it happens. Because, you know, by half an hour before the event actually kicks off, you've pretty much told everybody you're going to tell with a slide on a website. So this is all controlled by a few lines of C# code. And of course, there will be links to this code in the show notes, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. So the code is the same for all of this, to put the slides up and to bring the slides down. Only the names of the variables change. So the variables include things like the name of the slide, the code for this given slide, because each one has its own code, the dates that it goes up and down, and the link, because the slides usually link to something about the event. So I was using a text replacement app called Phrase Express, and changing the names. And I'll have a link to Phrase Express in the show notes as well. Now, I want to do a quick thing here on text replacement applications and software, because if you are at all in a development environment or an environment where you typically write the sort of same thing over and over again, you need a text replacement app. I really recommend this. Phrase Express is free and it's awesome. And there are text replacement apps for OS X and for Linux and for pretty much anything else. And what these things do, if you've never heard of one, is you give the text replacement app a trigger, and it's usually a word that will not come up in normal conversation. It doesn't even have to be a word. It can be words scrunched together. It can be a simple set of symbols, whatever. It can be whatever you want. And when you type that, it takes that and replaces it with the text that you actually want. So something you could do as a signature on your email is you could say, this is my default signature. Here is my name. Here is my title. Here is where I work, where you can contact me. You know, whatever you want your email signature, and you set that out. And then you give it a trigger of def sig for default signature. Now, def sig isn't a word. You're not really going to type that by accident. It's not going to come up in a conversation or whatever. So whenever you type def sig, D-E-F-S-I-G, instead of typing that out, it erases it and then pops in your signature. Anywhere. It can be in an email, it can be in a text document, it can be in a Word doc, whatever. Whenever you type def sig, you're going to get your default signature. Now, that is excellent, especially for things like Ask a Librarian services, where you're actually working, say, with more of a web form rather than straight email, because if you're using Outlook, you can save your signature anyway. You don't really need the text replacement app for that. But if you're working on an Ask a Librarian thing where you've got a website and you're sending email through that website rather than through your own Outlook client, and you want to put a signature on that, well, here you go. You don't have to keep copy and pasting. You don't have to keep typing the whole thing out. You just type defsig or whatever you want to call it, and boom, there's your email signature. And that'll work for anything. So I had this set up that when I typed new slide without a space, it just populated the code that I needed. And I went around and I changed the variables. Now that's fine, but it's the holidays. We've got quite a few things going on at all the branches. And that was getting tedious. I mean, you know, by the 20th time in a week that I've had to type new slide and change little fiddly things here and there, I was thinking there has to be a better way to do this. So I decided to write some code in AutoHotKey, which is kind of a scripting language. It's sort of like batch files on steroids. And I decided to write some code in AutoHotKey to automate this process a bit more. And with AutoHotKey, you can create a GUI-based form, a graphical user interface form, that asks for all the necessary fields for this slide thing. And that's what I did. And the cool thing is that this GUI also has calendar widgets, which makes it really easy to plan when your slide goes up and when your slide comes down. You can just see the calendar. So if you know your event is on, say, the 27th, and you want that slide to go live 8 days before, or the Wednesday before, or the Monday before, you can just click it. It's that simple. It takes the input from those forms, and then it creates the code. So, yes, I kind of wrote some code that writes code for me, but it's a lot easier. And if you just fill out the form, you get the code. It copies it to the clipboard, and I paste it into my editor. It's really cool. So if you happen to be running a Polaris pack, a public access catalog, and you have a slide deck or you have something like this that you might need, I will have a link in the show notes to the GitHub account that I've uploaded it to, because I share all of my code. Everything I do is open source. It's not elegant code. It's not even pretty code, but it works. And I know it works because I use it something like, at least 15 times last week. And the fun thing about C# code is if it's wrong, it crashes the pack. So it's pretty obvious pretty quickly when you've done something wrong. And I never crashed the pack. It was amazing. It was beautiful. There's no typos because it eliminates the typos. There's no formatting errors because it eliminates the formatting errors. It's just popping in the information that you give it. And that is pretty special, at least as far as my job goes. Now, you don't have to use this just for slides. You could use it for anything because this C# code works anywhere in the pack. So link in the show notes, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast, to the GitHub that's up on. And you can download it. You can play with it. AutoHotKey itself is free and open source. There'll be links to that as well. And, you know, check it out. It might be useful to you. I might be the only one in the world that might get some use out of this at all. But it's pretty useful for me, and it saved me a bunch of time already. Just within the last week, I've probably saved at least an hour when it comes to formatting, getting things in, making sure it doesn't break the site, things like that. So that's what's going on at work. Let's talk about the things I get up to at home. So I don't know what it says about me and my geekiness when I work on the web at work and then I come home and work on the web some more. But the projects are different, of course, because at home I can do things that, you know, I'm not allowed to do at work. And after all, it's my own hardware so I can do anything I want. It's my own stuff. So one of the things I got up to was setting up a server that I could access on the open internet, on the open web, and do interesting things with. Now, I've done stuff like this before, but I really never set out with a plan. And this time I did. I wanted actually four things on this. It worked out to be four, but let's just say I wanted three things. I wanted some kind of blogging type content management system. I wanted an image gallery and I wanted a Minecraft server because I wanted something for the kids and I to play on, and the kids with their friends can get on it and play on it too. So I've got this box here, and it's just a standard sort of Dell desktop box, but it's oldish. It's not very new at all, but it's got enough hardware to run Kubuntu, which is my Linux flavor of choice. I do love myself some Kubuntu and the KDE desktop environment. So I set up Kubuntu on it, and before some of the Linux fans and Linux nerds get on me about installing a graphical user environment on a server, I'm going to just say right now that I see nothing wrong with this. It's been done on Windows and OS X for years. IIS is a damn fine server, and it's graphically based. I have no problem running a GUI on a Linux server. I find that it eliminates many headaches. Now, goodness knows, I know how to use a command line interface, and I open Terminal a lot in any GUI. I run a lot of stuff in Terminal on OS X, and I open console almost immediately logging into my Kubuntu web server. Because let's face it, command line stuff is quicker. It's usually easier, especially if you've got something that's sort of complex, but you know the command to get the job done. But sometimes I just need to move files from one place to another. I need Samba. I would like to just drag icons instead of typing long commands. There's nothing wrong with having a GUI on a Linux server, so I would advise some of the Linux people out there to just sort of get over that. There have been GUI-based servers for decades. It's not a problem. If you want to run Ubuntu server on nothing but the command line, dandy, have at it. I'm not going to stop you, but I'm also not going to say it's the only way to do it. So I can't afford a lamp stack. I cannot afford things like IIS. And like I said, I kind of like IIS. It's a pretty decent web server. But I can afford a lamp stack. Now, if you don't know what LAMP is short for Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. Linux is the operating system, Apache is the web server, MySQL is the database backend, and PHP is sort of the language that makes them all talk to each other very nicely. So this is a pretty standard setup, and you can easily set up LAMP on any flavor of Ubuntu. I'll have a link in the show notes. You can pick it up there. It's just to the Ubuntu help document on how to do this. I wouldn't say it's straightforward all the time, because there are times when something doesn't work and I have to go spelunking to kind of figure out why. But between this document and Google, you will probably figure it out fairly quickly if you have any Linux acumen at all. So I set up a LAMP stack, and there's a problem though, because this is sitting in my house. I really don't have a lot of access to it outside the house. I mean, I've got my own internal web server. Yay, I can sit at my desk and access the web server behind me, and it's literally behind me as I record this podcast. But that's not useful. I want to be able to access it from a website, you know, from a site elsewhere. I want to go to a coffee shop and fiddle with it. I occasionally want to bring it up at work and make a quick change to it because I'm trying something there that I'm going to migrate over to my job at work, you know, and it's, I can break my own stuff. That's not a problem. So I need to be able to access this elsewhere. But like most people, I have just cable internet access at home that sort of changes my IP occasionally. And that's bad. I mean, if my IP was static, which is what most web server IPs are, that's okay, because you can set up DNS servers and stuff like that and be able to set up a user, you know, an environment for it. I don't have that. So there is a great service called NoIP, that's no-IP, link in the show notes, that does dynamic DNS management. And it's pretty simple. They have this thing called a dynamic updating client, a DUC, or the DUC, that basically is a little thing you install on a computer in your house. It does not have to be the server. It just needs to be something that's, you know, online. So while I have my Linux server running the website and all of that stuff, my dynamic DNS updating client, the DUC, is actually sitting on my Mac Mini because it's always on too. And I don't really need to fiddle with it. Once you install it and kind of get logged in and set up, you just kind of walk away. It just does what it needs to do, and it's pretty much fire and forget. So links in the show notes to NoIP. Pretty easy setup for dynamic DNS stuff like that. So with that, I can say here is my URL that I want to go to, and I'm not going to share that on the show right now. It's not ready, and I don't really have anything interesting there yet. I'll probably update y'all on it later on, but it's out there and it works. So you're going to have to take my word for that. I'm not going to lie to you. So I installed LAMP on my server. I installed NoIP on the Mac Mini. And then I set up a thing on my server called PHP MyAdmin. Now, web people who work with open source stuff like Linux and Apache will be nodding their heads if they hear the word, you know, PHP MyAdmin. PHP MyAdmin is simply a web-based, more friendly graphical way of talking to SQL databases in their native language. And it's specifically for MySQL. So you can use PHP MyAdmin to set up databases, to set up users for those databases, and you just click a few things and fill out a couple boxes and click submit, and it does the work for you, which is great because I can speak a little SQL, but I am far from fluent in SQL. And if I have something that can talk to SQL for me and do all the heavy lifting for me, all's the better. So PHP MyAdmin, if you're going to set up a LAMP stack and you need database assistance, that is the thing to use. So I wanted a few basic things, and I wound up with four, although I only set out for three at the beginning. I wanted some kind of blog type content management system, and I wanted a gallery of some kind for images. And like I said, I wanted a Minecraft server too. We'll talk about that in a second. So I've been using Gallery 3, which is an open source web-based image gallery. It's awesome, and I love it. However, the developers for that have sort of gone on hiatus. They haven't declared it dead, but they're not really actively working on it right now, which is okay. Developers have lives. They have families. They have pressing concerns that doesn't always involve the software. So, okay, Gallery 3 is still a going concern, but it's not getting updated. So I was looking for something that is getting updated and is still a going concern. And there's another one called Coppermine, all one word, Coppermine. And it's pretty cool. I've used it before, and it's getting steady updates and is still being worked on. So it's like, okay, Coppermine, I can look into that. So that was my image gallery. And of course, when it came to some kind of blog type CMS, WordPress is my platform of choice. But I've always had issues getting it running. More on that in a minute. But so I wanted WordPress and I wanted Coppermine. But I wanted something simple to fall back on because, like I said, I've always had issues getting WordPress running on a local server that goes out to the open web. So I wanted something simple that I could fall back on if I just could not get it working. And I Googled around a bit and I discovered this thing called Anchor CMS. That's Anchor as in like a boat anchor. And I really freaking like it. I will have links to that in the show notes as well. There are going to be a lot of links in these show notes, people. Cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. Check those out. Going to find some interesting stuff there this time around. But Anchor CMS is a blogging and content management platform, and it's really pretty and it's really simple to use. Now, by simple, I mean it doesn't have all the bells and whistles that you would find in WordPress. That's not what it's for. I would put it somewhere as far as like feature-rific and ease of use. I would put it somewhere between Tumblr and WordPress, where Tumblr is really easy to use. And we all know that it's easy to use because I swear to God, there are 5-year-olds on Tumblr. All you have to do is look around Tumblr for a little bit. You will find people that are 5 years old. And if they're not 5 years old, they have the mentality of a 5-year-old. And then WordPress, which is sort of like the open source blogging platform of choice for, you know, millions of websites. It's got a lot of features. It has a learning curve, though. And somewhere in between those two sits Anchor CMS. And you can create some beautiful sites with that. So I started fiddling with that. And in the end, I wound up having both. But like I said, more on that in a sec. Let's talk about Coppermine, because one of the things I really wanted, I mean, if I could not get the blogging content management system, I wanted an image gallery. So I looked into Coppermine, and it's got two interfaces to install it. Now, it's sort of your regular run-of-the-mill PHP MySQL install, where they just sort of follow a pattern. You need to create a database for the application. You need to create a user for that database. You need to give that user access to the database and, you know, the passwords and stuff like that. And then after you put the files needed for the application on your web server, you typically go to an install.php and start filling out forms. That's pretty much what WordPress does. That's kind of what Anchor does. That is exactly what Coppermine does. But Coppermine has two interfaces for this. They've got sort of the new and improved interface, and they've got a classic interface. Now, the new and improved interface could not get it to work. It kept borking. It was giving me SQL errors. I blew it away a couple times and started over, which was not a problem. Actually, all of the stuff, you know, was sitting right there on the server. It's like, well, crap, let me just delete this directory. The original Coppermine files are in my download directory still. I'll just copy them over and start from scratch. So that was fine. And I found out that Coppermine doesn't like special characters and passwords. So if you're using an exclamation point or a, you know, a pound sign or the hashtag, dollar sign, whatever, it just doesn't seem to like that. So if you're going to create a secure password in Coppermine, I suggest you create a long one using, you know, uppercase, lowercase letters, lots of numbers, things like that. So once I figured that out, I tried it in the classic interface and it went through on the first try. So if you're installing Coppermine at home on your own sort of Ubuntu web server, try the classic interface. It offers you a link. I suggest you click it. So once I got that and, you know, once I got that figured out, it was a quick install. I had it up and running probably 5 minutes after I initially went to install.php. And then, boom, got myself a wonderful image database and image gallery that I can put online and share with friends and family when the time comes. Now, WordPress. WordPress has always been a bear for me at home. I've installed I don't know how many instances of WordPress on the open web, on web servers at GoDaddy or DreamHost or whatever. But at home, I've always had this issue. And the issue is I can install it fine on the server, but when I try to access it from an outside URL, it either looks crap or it won't come up at all. It won't pull the style sheets, it won't pull the style sheets or the CSS. Some of the stuff just does not work. And I had tried changing URLs and I tried editing files and functions.php and making things try this, try that, reading God knows how many pages of the forums and the codex to figure out what was going on. And I kind of stumbled across this post in a forum that sorted it all out in basically two sentences, and I wish I had found this, say, a year ago when I was fiddling with this before. If you're going to install WordPress on a server, you need to invoke the install.php from the URL you're going to access the blog from. I did not know that. That could be common knowledge. There could be people listening to this podcast that are going, well, duh, Dan, you should have known that. I didn't know that. So when I tried that, because it was basically one of those things like, well, crap, I haven't tried this yet. I may as well give it a shot. It worked. Everything worked. When I came in from the URL that I'm going to be accessing the blog site from, you know, from the outside world and called install.php, I filled out the form and, you know, WordPress has the famous 5 minute installation. It probably took 3.5. So yeah, if you're installing WordPress locally on a local server that like sits in your office and you want to be able to access that from the outside world, make sure you call install.php from that URL that you're going to access the site from, you know, from the outside world. Makes everything better. Will save you hours of work and looking through forum posts and everything else. So, okay. And then somewhere in there, I tried this Anchor CMS, and wow, I was really impressed with that, and I still am. I'm still going to fiddle around with it. So now I've got like two blogging and content management systems on this web server, and Anchor, pretty much the same install process as WordPress. As a matter of fact, they kind of take a little dig at WordPress. If you read some of their documentation, they'll talk about, quote, you know, another websites or something like that, you know, another web content management system's famous 5-minute installation, and Anchor CMS will only take you 2. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's funny. So they take a little dig at WordPress there, but they're absolutely right. Once you get the database and that kind of stuff set up in the background and you start the install process, you basically fill out a quick 5 to 6 field page of information and hit submit, and boom, you have an Anchor CMS blog. It's that simple. And you can change everything later on as you want. So I started fiddling with that. The way themes work in Anchor CMS is a little different because not only do you install the theme, you also have to set up custom fields for the theme. It doesn't do that for you, but there's always a README file, or at least there should be a README file with the theme that says, hey, for images, you're going to have to set up a custom field called this. It has to have these settings. And really, if you can read that, and then you can go set up that custom field in the management system, in the admin area of Anchor CMS, you're just going to follow the directions. It's all right there to fill out and click and invoke and everything like that. So I installed a different theme. I don't remember the title of it off the top of my head, but it's sort of a standard theme, and it's really cool. It's responsive. It has a totally responsive design, this theme. You're able to upload images just like you can on WordPress. It handles the display of the images, and it just makes everything very easy. So Anchor CMS is one of those things that I think I would advise people to keep an eye on, because it's one of those that could come from behind and just explode onto the scene, because it's really pretty. It's got sort of more features than Tumblr. Not as many as WordPress, but I could see it just sort of sitting right there in the middle for people who want something simple to use, but is not Tumblr. Because unfortunately, if you want to use Tumblr, you have to use Tumblr. There is, to my knowledge, no sort of thing that's like Tumblr that isn't Tumblr. So Anchor CMS, pretty cool. I suggest you check that out. Now, I have a web server with cool apps to fiddle with and host some images for friends and stuff, and I can play around with WordPress and Anchor, and it's great, and it's mine. This is not something that's sitting in a server rack someplace else where I can't touch it. I have no idea where it is. I have to follow somebody else's rules, whatever. This is mine. This is my stuff. And if I, you know, don't like what's happening, I can fix it, or I can blow it away and start over. It's my stuff, which is kind of cool. And finally, for this show, the Minecraft server. Now, Minecraft is devilishly easy to set up. And if you've never played Minecraft or you don't know what Minecraft is, wow, I cannot help you with that. Google is your friend. Google Minecraft, you will probably know it when you see it if you did not know what it was before. Because if you've worked in a library, you've probably seen kids playing Minecraft. It's basically digital Lego. But Minecraft has a great thing where you can run a server. And the server itself is free. That's the cool thing about Minecraft. The server is free. If you want to play on the server, you need a client. And that's what you pay for. You have to pay for the client. The server, anyone can get it. Anyone can set it up. So there's servers for OS X and Windows. But since I'm running a Linux server, I wanted the Minecraft for Linux server. So I downloaded that. And turns out the installation is easy. You basically unzip it into the directory you want it to run in. It can even be your own home directory in your user folder. That's fine. And there's a link in the show notes for getting it up and running. Basically, there is a command line to launch it. Now, you will need Java because Minecraft is totally coded in Java. It's Java-based. You simply need Java. So there is a command to find out if you have Java, what the version is, and all of that. Like I said, check out the link in the show notes. There is a beautiful tutorial on how to get it running on a DigitalOcean droplet, which they run sort of Ubuntu, I believe. If not straight Ubuntu, then they run something that's very much like Ubuntu. And all of the instructions work, because I literally just went down step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4. And by the time I got to the last step, I had a working Minecraft server. It was that easy. So this is great, because now I can play with my kids on the Minecraft server, because both my son and daughter like to fiddle with Minecraft. But they can also call up their friends and say, hey, my dad set up a Minecraft server. Do you want to get on and play? And I believe my son's already been doing that with some of his friends at school. So, you know, hey, that's kind of fun to have. So you got something for your kids to fiddle around with. You know the hardware that it's running on. You know where that hardware lives. You know who they're talking to because you can just pop into the logs and say, hey, who is Barry6104? Oh, well, that's my friend. Oh, okay, no problem then. You know, but if I pop in there and say, you know, someone that I don't know and that my son doesn't know, well, then we have a problem. You don't have that level of control over Minecraft servers that aren't on your own hardware. So like I said, one command to run it, link in the show notes, check those out. And that's what I've been up to at home, and that's what I've been up to at work. As you can see, there's some overlap there, because after all, I'm a web guy at work, I'm a web guy when I get home, and really, it's just fun to kind of geek out on your own projects, even when the stuff at work is fun too. So hey, thank you for tuning into this episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. It was a little longer and a little more tech-heavy than I normally put out there, but hey, it was kind of fun talking about some of the projects that I'm doing at work and at home and sort of the overlap between them. And I hope that you yourself have some projects that you're working on, something you're going to get something out of, but also something that brings you a little bit of joy. Because let's face it, I like working on website stuff, but it's not for everybody. And, you know, if you're a tech head, but you're not into the web stuff, maybe you're more of a content creator or something like that. I hope you get a project you're working on both at work and at home that makes things a little bit more worthwhile and gives you something to look forward to, something that's there that you can hammer on as you want to and get something out of it when you're done. The music you're currently digging on is Destiny by Atomic Cat. Earlier in the show, you heard Hypodemia by Nexus and Rocket by Kevin MacLeod. I will have links for all of those tracks at the in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast, where you can pick up a bunch more links about the things we talked about today on the show. So all kinds of content management systems and how-tos and things like that. So check it out, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast for the show notes, and you can learn more there. And hey, if you want to drop a comment there, you certainly can. You know, tell me what you thought of the show. Tell me if you've got an idea for a future show. Anything like that. I love to hear from the listeners. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I am at Bibrarian. That's B-I-B-R-A-R-I-A-N. It's like librarian, but it starts with a B. You can also hit me up on Google Plus. I am google.com/plusDanielMesser. You can pick me up that way. And if you want to try the old version of the SMTP thing that seems to work pretty well, but Google seems to be screwing with a little bit here and there, well, I'm still available that way, and you can hit me up at cyberpunklibrarian@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you, love to hear any show suggestions, anything you want to hear me talk about. Tell me what you thought of the show, tell me what you liked, what you didn't like. That's what I am here for. I speak to serve on these podcasts. Speaking of service, this podcast is hosted by The Archive, the Internet Archive at archive.org. You need to check out The Archive. Not only will you find podcasts like this one and podcasts better than this one, you're going to find some great content like the Prelinger Archive, a great video archive that you can use stuff from if you need to. But they've also got the Old School Emulation Center, tons of games from the glory days of video gaming. You have stuff from the Apple II, the Commodore 64, Sega Genesis, all kinds of great stuff. Check it. If you do nothing else at archive.org, you got to check out their video game center. Stuff you can just play right there, right in your browser. It's awesome, especially if you're a fan of retro gaming like I am. Big shout out to The Archive for hosting not only this podcast, but all kinds of great content. Check them out, archive.org. And that about wraps up this episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. Hey, if you want to chip into the GoFundMe campaign to send me to Minneapolis to speak at the Innovative Users Group, I would certainly appreciate that. You can get more information at GoFund.me/CyberpunkLibrarian. There'll be links in the show notes. And, you know, if you can chip in a little bit, that would be great. It'd help to offset the cost of making a trip from Arizona to Minnesota. And yeah, that's going to be a little bit expensive, you know, airfare, hotel, whatever. So anything helps. And I thank you for any contribution you can make. And if you can't make a contribution, hey, that's okay. I thank you for tuning into this show regardless. And just before we get out of here, I want to remind you, you don't have to be high tech to be low budget, but it certainly helps if you're a cyberpunk. Take care. I'll see you on the next episode.